We're now ready to hear argument from the petitioner in Phillips against Phillips.
May it please the court, petitioner Martha Jean Phillips seeks the enforcement of the stipulated damage clause for the breach of fiduciary duty. The enforcement of that clause has been denied to her by a holding that the clause was a penalty. That holding is wrong because penalty is an affirmative defense. It was never pled by the respondents. Respondents never presented any proof during the trial that the clause was a penalty, and the record shows that the respondent during the trial tried to use the clause that's in question for his own benefit. Now, the contract that we're talking about is a limited partnership agreement. It was a limited partnership that was entered into as part of a marriage settlement agreement. Harry Phillips and Marjean Phillips had been married for 32 years. They got divorced. They had accumulated substantial properties, oil and gas properties, and real estate during their life. The marriage settlement agreement contemplated an equal division of those properties, net value of approximately $18 million or $9 million apiece. Then the marriage settlement agreement provided that Marjean Phillips would contribute her properties to the limited partnership, that she would be a sole limited partner of this partnership, and that Harry Phillips, her ex-husband, would be the general partner. He would contribute these properties to a limited partnership, and he would operate these properties. He would have sole and absolute dominion and control over these properties, and he would pay to her minimum monthly distributions, beginning in the amount of $21,000 per month. He also made other agreements in this limited partnership agreement. One agreement that he specified, he was going to act as her fiduciary. And the agreement provides, under section 16.2, if the general partner breaches his trust hereunder, he shall pay to the limited partner as liquidated damages 10 times the amount she loses as a result of such breach. This contract was introduced into evidence during the time of the trial, and the enforceability of this clause was never questioned. To the contrary, Mr. Phillips, during his testimony, after the plaintiff had rested their case, in response to questions by his trial counsel, Otis Carroll, had this exchange. It's in the statement of facts on page 494. They're discussing various provisions of the limited partnership agreement. Mr. Carroll asks, there's another interesting provision in there that says that if Mrs. Phillips can show that you have breached your fiduciary duty to her, that you will be obligated to pay to her 10 times any amount that she proves. Are you familiar with that? Mr. Phillips answers, yes, sir. Mr. Carroll, how in the world did that get in there? Answer, I wanted her to let me wanted to prove to her that I would not do anything wrong. So I put it in myself. Was it your idea? Yes, sir. So that Mr. Phillips, in the trial of this case, wants the jury, during the trial, to understand that he made an agreement to pay Mrs. Phillips 10 times what she can prove for breach of fiduciary duty. He wants the jury to understand.
You contend the provision is not a penalty, even if it's a part of the pleading problem.
Yes, sir. I contend that in this case, this provision is not a penalty.
Is it your position that that particular clause was the consideration for the wife placing all of her assets subject to control of the husband?
I think that it was a material provision. She testified that clause gave her comfort. And he testified that it was an inducement to her to put her property in the partnership. He was a fiduciary to her. It was his idea to put it in, so he induced her to put it in. He used it to try to show to the jury that he didn't do anything wrong, just like he tried to induce Mrs. Phillips to put her property in the partnership by saying he wouldn't do anything wrong. Now, there is nothing in the record that would indicate that this clause is a penalty. Now, the Court of Appeals in Tyler's cites Stewart versus Basie, and the respondent cites Stewart versus Basie for the proposition that this particular clause is a penalty on its face and is illegal and therefore does not have to be pled. Stewart versus Basie doesn't say that you do not have to plead an affirmative defense with regard to a liquidated damage clause. Stewart versus Basie recites the general rule that in order for a liquidated damage clause to be enforceable, it's got to be used in connection with a breach that is difficult, if not that is difficult, if not impossible to calculate, and it must be a reasonable estimate of the damages. But
this one doesn't fit under either one of them.
Fits under both of them. Fits under both of them.
You now have a provision that says you get 10 times what you actually lost, take into account something that can't be calculated.
Well,
you have to calculate the loss before you calculate the penalty.
Well, but this says this is not a breach of contract regarding the stipulated damages for breach of contract. This is a stipulated damage clause for breach of fiduciary duty. And fiduciary duty entitles the person that suffers the breach of fiduciary duty such damages in addition to the loss. I mean, how can you measure what Mrs. Phillips has gone through because of the breach of the fiduciary duty of Mr. Phillips?
Is there any testimony as to whether or not she would have entered into this agreement without that clause?
The only testimony is Mr. Phillips' testimony. But to get back to your question, is you've got a whole range of damages for breach of fiduciary duty. That points out one of the reasons that we were prejudiced in this case when they didn't plead it. If he would have pled that this was a penalty and it was non-enforceable, we would have an opportunity to prove, as you suggest, that he fraudulently induced her to enter into this contract, that he wasn't going to enforce this provision, wasn't going to be enforced, and he represented that he was going to pay her 10 times. We could have used that for fraudulent inducement cause of action. In addition, we could have sought exemplary or punitive damages for breach of fiduciary duty, which we did not, because we had a contract that gave us 10 times the amount that we proved in connection with the economic loss to her. So this is not the normal breach of contract case, but I do think it may reach those two issues that you asked. How can you calculate with breach of fiduciary duty what damages are for breach of fiduciary duty? And who is to say that 10 times the economic loss is not unreasonable? There was no testimony for that. I've seen cases where exemplary damages exceed 10 times the economic loss. But the point is, it wasn't raised, it wasn't addressed, and Mr. Phillips tried to use it in his own behalf. Now, the Stewart versus Basie case doesn't say that you don't have to plead an affirmative defense, and you don't have to plead that a contract is a penalty. We did not find any cases at all regarding affirmative defenses and an affirmative defense not being required to be pled because on its face it was affirmative defense, except in the cases regarding illegality with which the respondent suffered. I don't know why an affirmative defense on penalty is not like an affirmative defense like release or affirmative defense like statute of limitations. Is the trial court going to have to sit back after the trial of the case and find out, is there any document that shows on its face that the statute of limitations has run? Is there any document that shows on its face that the claim has been released? This is an affirmative defense that was the defendant's burden to plead and to prove. There's nothing that we could find that holds a liquidated damage provision to be illegal. In this particular case, this provision is not illegal. This
says Stewart versus Basie.
No, it did not. What it held in Stewart versus Basie was that in order for a liquidated damage clause to be enforceable, you have to prove or it has to be shown that the damages are difficult, if not impossible, to calculate, and two, that the damages were not unreasonable.
And if it's not, then it's not illegal?
Then it's not a penalty. And there's no case that we found that held penalty was illegal. The cases that they have cited on illegality deal with instances where a document shows or the pleadings show on its face that there's been some violation of some statute or some penal code. On page 5 of the supplemental brief that the respondent filed just a few days ago, he makes a statement on page 5 that there is cases on holding that cases dealing with penalty do not have to be pled, and he cites three cases. Those cases are miscited. Those cases do not have anything to do with a penalty. Those three cases, Lawyer versus Aramco, is one of the cases, and that deals with the restraint of trade that was shown on the face of the document to be in violation of the antitrust statute. The case of After Hours Inc. versus Sherrard is also not a case regarding liquidated damages or a penalty. It's a restraint of trade case involving an antitrust statute, violation of an antitrust statute. In the case of Kirby versus Cruz, which is cited also on the same page 5 of the supplemental brief, is a case in regarding illegality, not a stipulated damage clause, but involves an insider in an official capacity who gives inside information in violation of the penal code. In Kirby versus Cruz, though, the court held that that was not illegal on its face and really shows how narrow the exception is, even with regard to illegality. The illegality has to be blatantly shown on the face of the document, and here they said it was not illegal and you had to look to other evidence. But there is no cases that we found that relate any other affirmative defense to this waiver issue, that you do not have to plead an affirmative defense. The only one we found was illegality. That does not relate to a penalty. This was not a pleading defect on behalf of the defendant. The defendant used the clause as part of his trial strategy and shouldn't be allowed now to come in and say this is unenforceable. He used it to try to convince the jury to show that he was innocent of any wrongdoing. He ought to be a stop to raise the issue now. In addition, he is a fiduciary. He was a fiduciary by virtue of the type of transaction it was and by the specific language in the document. As a fiduciary and as a defendant, it was his burden to plead, and it was his burden to prove that this was not a liquidated, that this was not a valid liquidated damage clause. It's his burden to come forward and to show, listen, you can compute these damages for breach of fiduciary duty very easily. It's his burden to show that, and he offered no evidence of it at all. In addition, it would be his burden to prove that the damages of 10 times economic loss are unreasonable. And he did neither of those. As I stated further, the fact that they did not make any type of pleading or presentation put us to a disadvantage because we were denied the opportunity to present evidence that it's not a penalty. If he would have raised it, we would have had an opportunity to present evidence and argument that it was not a penalty.
What evidence?
Well, the first evidence is the language of the document itself. The parties call it a liquidated damage clause. They don't call it a penalty.
That's already in it.
All right. Evidence that, that's evidence that's in the record. Additional evidence by an expert that breach of fiduciary duty encompasses lots of types of damages and not just economic loss.
It's a matter of law.
Well, I have cases all the time where experts are testifying about breach of fiduciary duty, advising the jury of what a fiduciary duty entails and what you have to do and why it is given such the law gives the responsibilities of a fiduciary great restraints and imposes upon fiduciaries a lot of burdens that they have to comply with during trial. But
any other evidence besides that?
The other evidence that was in the trial is the fact that this is a contract that was entered into, a limited partnership agreement entered into, not a contract between Exxon and Texaco, but a contract between two people that were getting a divorce, that she did not want to continue to remain tied to her husband, but did it because of the promises that he made in this contract, promises that he would act as a fiduciary and be responsible to her for 10 times the amount of her loss. This contract was incorporated in the marriage settlement agreement. The marriage settlement agreement was signed by both counsel for the parties. The court, the divorce court, as part of the transcript, approved the marriage settlement agreement and the limited partnership agreement and found that it was reasonable and fair and that it was in the best interest of the parties and incorporated the limited partnership agreement in the decree. So that's the proof that we have that that there's not an illegality here and that it's not a penalty. And that the additional evidence that we could have offered, if it would have been raised, it's hard for me to anticipate everything that we would have done, but I think I've answered the question to the extent that I can. Other issue that they have raised is that the question respondents raise is that the issue to the jury goes to breach of fiduciary duty and the document says it's a breach of trust. We submit that they're the same thing and that in the event that there is some error in the issue that it was waived, that there was no objection made by the respondent. And gentlemen, if there are any additional questions, otherwise I have finished.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
We now hear arguments from the respondent.
Please, the court. Mr. Patrick Kelly will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court. Quite simply, as the petitioner stated, he seeks to recover a multiplier 10 times the damages found by the jury on the theory that the clause in question was not pled defensively as a penalty. An affirmative defense is in the nature of confession and avoidance, and the purpose of it is to raise an issue that there are facts not set forth in the plaintiff's petition, which would allow the defendant to avoid or limit liability. Rule 94 sets forth several affirmative defenses, specifically such as fraud, discharge, and bankruptcy, and others. These are all matters that require a factual determination by the court or the jury on that defensive issue. That is not the case in the matter before this court. Every fact concerning paragraph 16.2 of the limited partnership agreement was pled by the plaintiff and placed in evidence by the plaintiff. The limited partnership agreement itself was in evidence, with plainly the 10 times figure. The multiplier clause was twice discussed specifically in front of the jury. Mrs. Phillips, the petitioner, read the clause in the record to the jury, and Mr. Phillips commented on it in the same manner as what Mr. Wilk just stated to the court. So there is no question that the 10 times multiplier figure or 10 times multiplier clause was before the jury. That being the case, every issue, every fact was pled and proved to the plaintiff, even if the defendant had pled penalty, which we believe was unnecessary. And the facts and evidence would have been duplicative on both the plaintiff's issue and the defendant's issue.
He says he would claim fraud and plead in the evidence.
Your Honor, that question came up, as I understood it, that he would claim or that there was a possibility of an issue of consideration in connection with whether or not that particular clause was consideration for Mrs. Phillips entering into the limited partnership agreement. Mrs. Phillips testified that she entered into the partnership agreement because even though Mr. Phillips was hard to live with, that she did think that he was very good at making money, and that this was a good deal for her. I cannot tell the court as far as what issues might or might not have been raised at a later time. The fact remains, however, that it is, I believe, ridiculous or absurd or any other adjectives of that nature to contend that a penalty which says 10 times actual damages, or a clause which says that, is not on its face a penalty. A liquidated damage clause consists of two elements, a true liquidated damage clause, which is that the parties recognize that damages are not going to be capable of precise determination, and they try to reach a formula where there is a fair estimation of what the damages are going to be. This does not fit either of those criteria. This says the jury finds actual damages, then we multiply it by 10. It is sort of an agreed penalty, if, for lack of a better term.
Counsel, when the parties divorced, they in effect dissolved one of the most solemn contracts that two people can enter into, did they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And normally at the end of a divorce, there's a great deal of distrust, which would naturally follow because of the dissolution of the marriage.
Yes, Your Honor.
And allowing an ex-husband to control all of the formerly community assets is placing a tremendous responsibility with him, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
And this clause is, whether we call it consideration or a comfort factor, could easily have been the consideration, could it not?
Your Honor, in speculation, yes, it could have been. In speculation, no, it might not have been. That issue is simply not one which has been addressed in any form.
I noticed what's been said today that we had an $18 million estate, each party apparently receiving approximately $9 million. If that estate really, one party was really worth $9 million, assuming you could earn 7%, that would be $630,000, yet she was only guaranteed $21,000 a month, which is approximately $270,000 a year, so she was really getting about a guarantee of about 3.5%.
That is correct, Your Honor, on a cash flow basis. However, she was also getting the benefit of what was expected out of that arrangement, which was that there would be substantial appreciation in the partnership based on the oil and gas properties and the real properties. Furthermore, there was testimony that Mr. Phillips considered this arrangement to be primarily for the benefit of their four children, as opposed to the benefit of himself or for the benefit of her.
Were any of the assets, any type of, was there a trust agreement set up for the benefit of the children?
Not at the time of the marriage settlement agreement or the limited partnership agreement, Your Honor.
I find it difficult to imagine that this clause could be an attempt to set actual damages, which are a different measure because the difficulty is always present in a breach of fiduciary case, and the clause itself requires an ascertainment before the penalty is imposed. But why isn't the clause an effort to set punitive damages, which would be recovered in a breach of fiduciary case?
Your Honor, the clause may well be an effort to set punitive damages. I cannot cite you anything from the record of pleadings as far as that being the case, and I simply do not want to speculate as to whether or not it was or was not an effort to set punitive damages. But if it was, then we would contend that it would be in the same nature as the enforceability or attempted enforceability of an illegal contract such as gambling, illegality being a specified Rule 94 affirmative defense. Both parties in that situation, such as a gambling contract, have agreed. Both parties theoretically have consideration. But the courts have decided that it is not a function of the courts to enforce contracts of that nature because it is not the proper function for the civil justice system. The courts have routinely refused to enforce valid liquidation clauses that were in effect penalties. The rule should be no different when the clause is a penalty or on its face, or that the clause is a penalty on its face or is one as a matter of law.
So your view is you can't have a liquidated damages provision that attempts to set punitive damages, which would be recoverable for the breach that is addressed.
I agree with the first part of your question. I'm not sure I understand the second part. That goes to an issue, quite frankly, which has not been raised, which is in matters of contract. Punitive or exemplary damages are normally not available.
Say this clause is just said. If there's a breach of fiduciary duty in this case, while the actual damages may be ascertainable, we recognize that punitive damages may be difficult to ascertain. The jury might award anything from 2 to 50 times the actual damages, and we don't want that to happen, so we agree on 10.
If that were the case, Your Honor, I would... you hit me with a question, quite frankly, that I hadn't even anticipated, but that's certainly not your problem, that's mine. Gets into whether or not parties can contractually or can agree by contract to punitive damages. I think that gets to the issue of the fact that punitive damages or exemplary damages are normally not allowed for breaches of contract, no matter whether that breach was egregious or whether that breach was simply negligent. It is our contention that even if this was pled as a penalty, that there would be no additional issue which would have that would have been placed before the jury, because there was no other issue of fact to be decided. The contract being before the jury, and there being no allegation by any party that this contract was ambiguous. The respondent, my client in this case, does not have any problem with the concept of having to plead a penalty when extraneous facts would show that the effect of the clause is a penalty. That would be an affirmative defense which extraneous facts must raise, such as bankruptcy or discharge in bankruptcy, fraud, things of that nature set forth in Rule 94 specifically. Here, as I said before, it is not a valid liquidated damage clause, but because it does not meet the two elements of a liquidated damage clause, it certainly is not a situation where damages are not capable of being determined, and one where a damage provision is a fair attempt to estimate what the actual damages are going to be. In a case such as this, where the provision is not a true liquidated damage clause, there should be no requirement for it to be pled, especially when there are no extraneous facts which even can be pled. As an additional point, one that was touched on by the attorney for the petitioner, and again, this is a point, I suppose, of definition as much as anything else, but it is the basis on which the petitioner predicates the request for the 10 times multiplier in that clause. Paragraph 16.2 of the agreement, which Mr. Wilk read to the court a moment ago, states that the multiplier shall be allowed for any damages arising from a breach of, quote, trust, unquote. The petitioner asserts here that trust and fiduciary duty are the same. We would contend that they are not. A fiduciary duty, which was defined in the charge by the court, is an obligation of one party. In this case, there is no question that it was Mr. Phillips' obligation. Trust can be many things. Trust can be the reliance placed upon one person by another. It can be a legal document with defined terms. It can be the nature of relationship, either business or personal. The breaches of fiduciary duty, which were found by the jury here, and what were the same elements of breaches of contract as well, were not that he failed to make distributions to her, or that he took money and she didn't get some. Instead, his breaches, as found by the jury, were in failing to keep good books and records, were in failing to prepare annual reports, and in failing to let Mrs. Phillips examine the books and records on a reasonable basis, that he hindered and delayed her in doing that. Those are all specific items which he was required to do for the contract. On a comparative basis, those types of breaches are not the type of conduct which necessarily would lead a jury to conclude that a breach of fiduciary duty, as defined by the court, is equivalent to a breach of trust, whatever in their minds that might mean, and which was not defined by the court.
Pretty hard to see the difference. You just look at that division of the contract. Breach of trust here under, kind of hard to see the difference between not providing records and not providing money.
Your Honor, I suggest that it is that the equivalency between breach of fiduciary duty and breach of trust is something which would be far more ascertainable to a lawyer, someone who deals in those matters, someone who is familiar with the way courts define terms. However, we had a lay jury which had a definition of one term and did not have the definition of the other. And I'm getting to the point about why that was particularly important in this case. The damage issue here, which was special issue number 3, asked for damages caused either by breach of contract or breach of fiduciary duty. It includes both of them. It is not limited simply to fiduciary duty. The plaintiff's request here is to multiply the actual damages found by the jury. Because a breach, the plaintiff's request to multiply the damages found by the jury assumes that all the damages come in under the breach of fiduciary duty. It ignores the fact that essentially the same issue was submitted and the same answers were given in connection with the breach of contract actions. Breach of contract action we submit under the terms of the partnership agreement would certainly not trigger the 10 times multiplier, even if it was valid. It also assumes that the jury did not already multiply by 10 times when they reached the $300,000 figure that they answered special issue number 3. Finally, as to our point of error as to the inclusion of attorney's fees, there is no question that the amount was stipulated. There's no question those are reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. Our point simply is that the damages were placed before the jury in final argument. The stipulation was not placed in evidence during the trial in chief. That the jury had that figure before them and that they included that in connection with their determination of $300,000 in damages. That's what the trial court determined, and we simply assert that, that should not be set aside by abuse of discretion. Any further questions?
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Governor.
We will now hear a rebuttal from the petitioner.
Last issues first. The one issue is that the jury issued described it as breach of fiduciary duty and not as breach of trust. And I would just call the Your Honor's attention to the fact that breach of trust, breach of fiduciary duty are the same thing, and that in the contract it talks about he's going to act as his fiduciary, and the next paragraph says if you have damages for breach of trust, and I think that those are so related. And more telling is Mr. Phillips' attorney during the trial, when he was talking about the contract, said, if Mrs. Phillips can show that you've breached your fiduciary duty, so he used the word fiduciary duty and not trust when he was referring to the clause. The issue regarding the fact that we had one jury answer of $300,000 of breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract, there was no objection made to the submission of the one damage issue. I call the court's attention to Birchfield versus Texarkana Memorial Hospital, 747 Southwest 2nd 361, which was decided by this court in 1987, and Wilgus, W-I-L-G-U-S versus Bond, 730 Southwest 2nd 670, also was decided by this court in 1987. It says that in those instances where you have various issues and various causes of actions and theories of recovery and you submit one damage issue and there's no objection, then you waive any objection on how that damage issue is applied, and it's applied to give you the largest recovery. The argument regarding the jury may have already multiplied this by 10 times when it filled in $300,000. I don't know how we know what the jury was thinking. There was evidence in the record, as the Court of Appeals recites in its opinion, that Mrs. Phillips had failed to receive over $2 million worth of distributions in breach of the contract, and that she had received $127,000 less in other ancillary distributions and expenses taken by Mr. Phillips, so that there was ample evidence in the record to indicate what those damages were. The breach of contract is in response to another special issue. The jury found that in each instance, each breach of contract was willful and intentional. Based on those findings and the breach of fiduciary duty finding, we submit that we would have been entitled to exemplary damages, and that exemplary damages were pled in our pleading. We made, if you look at the pleading that we went to trial with, we had an alternative theory of recovery. One, exemplary damages, or in the alternative, 10 times actual damages. So there was no secret that we were trying to recover on those different theories. We see no reason and have seen no authority that would deny the enforceability of this clause because it involves a stipulated damage provision for a tort, a breach of fiduciary duty, not contract. Under this tort, you'd be entitled to recover punitive damages. And that issue meets the two tests that are set out in the cases regarding the enforceability of stipulated damage provisions. One, they're difficult to calculate, and two, they're not unreasonable. But that issue, we submit, is really not before this court because it was never before the trial court. No one even pretended this was a penalty. No one even pretended that it was unenforceable. Mr. Phillips took the position when he told the jury, yeah, I agreed to do that, that it was enforceable. I don't think that this provision is a penalty, but based upon the circumstances of this case, how this provision arose, under the consequences of this provision arising in a divorce agreement, where Mrs. Phillips was induced by the admission of Mr. Phillips to turn over everything she had, $9 million, substantially everything she had to him, in exchange for agreed distributions. Those distributions weren't made. The jury found that he breached his contract not making those distributions, that he was willful and intentional in not making those distributions. There was evidence in the record there was over $2 million distributions not made. There was evidence in the record that he took $127,000 out of the partnership that he couldn't account for. There was evidence in the record requiring the trial judge to dissolve the partnership finally. It was entered into in 1976, in 1987 we have a jury award, and in 1988 the judge enters a judgment regarding dissolution of the partnership. We did not appeal from that decision. Mr. Phillips, as the record will indicate, because we had to postpone our oral argument in Tyler, put Phillips and Phillips Limited, the limited partnership, into Chapter 11. To this day, we have not received. Mrs. Phillips has not received any assets upon dissolution of this partnership. She has not received any distributions. Even if this stipulation is construed to be a penalty, which we don't believe it is, it would be more offensive to public policy to refuse to enforce this provision than it would be to create some exception to the affirmative duty to plead an affirmative defense, and for the defendant to prove. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. All cases this morning are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business in court. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Can you watch this?